Good morning, everyone. This is the 565th day of the war in Europe. Our staff reporters are waiting at their mics in England, Germany, and Washington, ready to give you the latest dispatches. First, the news in England. Go ahead, London.
This is John McVain in London. German raiders last night made their heaviest raid on London since the financial section was set afire on the last Sunday in 1940. The raiders came from all directions to rain down thousands of incendiaries and high explosives. An area of 30 to 40 square miles was lit up as the fire watchers fought the bombs and the flames. The bombers attacked in groups of twos and threes and dropped some heavy bombs. One street was virtually blown out of existence. Gas, water, and electricity lines were cut in the area most heavily bombed, and no buses could run in the district. One German bomber is officially stated to have been shot down. Outside London, little damage was done. British bombers last night made a heavy attack on Cologne. Railways and the Rhine Canal system were bombed, and pilots reported many fires. This was the 62nd raid on Cologne, where Germany has many armament factories. Oil storage tanks at Rotterdam were again attacked, and three aerodromes in the Low Countries were raided. All the British planes returned safely. Referring to reports that the Vatican is worried about the safety of Italian civilians in Italian East Africa, it was officially stated in London today that Britain is unable to guarantee protection for non-combatants deserted by retreating Italian troops. Unless the Italian government makes a request for such protection as part of a general capitulation, the British will continue their humane treatment of prisoners but can't be responsible for the excesses of irregular native troops. Although the Emperor Haile Selassie has been asked to restrain his men from taking reprisals. However, there must be a lot of Italians in East Africa today who remember that when the Italian mechanized forces rolled through Abyssinia a few years back, Italian planes sprayed mustard gas on thousands of tribesmen defenseless against such warfare who were blinded or died later in great agony. And they must wonder whether the Abyssinians remember too. Radio and press correspondents yesterday met Professor Noel Hall, who is going to the British Embassy in Washington with the rank of minister and the job of collaborating with Lord Halifax on all questions concerning economic warfare. During the war, he's been a director of the Ministry of Economic Warfare here and is recognized as one of Britain's greatest experts on economics. He told us that he is going to Washington on the biggest humanitarian job that ever fell to man. He spoke of the decimation of Europe's young men in the last war, and said the only way to avoid repeating this was to keep up firm economic pressure on Germany through the blockade. The new minister didn't say much about France, except that the British are willing to let in medical stores and children's clothing, as long as it's carefully distributed by the Red Cross. But there isn't any doubt that British public opinion as a whole is extremely worried by what seems to them to be an attempt by some quarters in America to abolish the blockade, which is Britain's chief weapon. As the British see it, Vichy France and Germany are coming into closer and closer economic collaboration. At a time when the attacks of German U-boats based on French ports are threatening to cut British food supply lines, the average Britisher feels that the Vichy outcry about the British blockade is a carefully timed and German-inspired move. Most people here are wondering why there has been no Vichy public complaints about the huge food stocks requisitioned by the Germans from unoccupied France, and the fact that the Axis is continually taking as much as 60% of foodstuffs arriving in the French Mediterranean ports. Admiral Dollon's recent threat about convoying French merchant vessels from North Africa is seen as a skillful German attempt to get the French fleet into the war on Germany's side. If the French fleet does convoy these vessels, it is said it'll be guarding foodstuffs, much of which in one form or another finds its way to Germany. The British understand the humanitarian motives behind the desire to send food to France, but they feel that if France is short of food, there is only one country responsible, that is Germany. And they feel if the Americans, whom they naturally don't want to oppose, insist on sending food into France, it will strengthen Germany's position, draw out the war, and cost a lot of lives that could have been saved. The British position is all the more difficult because of the constant German infiltration into French North Africa. The other day, I had a long talk with a Frenchman of undoubted standing who has just reached London from Morocco. He said that hundreds of so-called German tourists have entered Morocco with Vichy government visas on their passports. He said that the official German Armistice Commission is busily engaged in laying out new aerodromes in various parts of the country. And he said the commission controls all aerodromes in the Casablanca region. German agents are said to be spending money freely and bribing native chiefs to turn against France. Moroccan troops captured in France were given special treatment by the Germans, and many are being sent back to do German propaganda work in their own country. This is John McBain in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
You have just heard from our reporter in London. From the Associated Press, Rome. Italian troops were reported today by the fascist high command to be holding off British attacks on the Marta Pass northeast of Jijiga in Ethiopia. We now hear the news from Berlin. Go ahead, Berlin.
This is Charles Lonnie from Berlin. Today, the Germans claim that a monster air attack last night on London was the biggest and most destructive they've carried out since war started. In a clear sky, the Germans sighted several hundred of their bombers flying in successive waves, pounded the city with bombs of all calibers for 6 hours. The attacks lasted until early this morning, and more than 10,000 incendiary bombs alone are said to have fallen on the British capital. According to the German High Command, the areas around the harbors and docks got the worst of the attack. It's claimed that the Royal Victoria docks, the Royal Albert docks, the King George V docks, and the harbor area of the Thames Estuary bore the brunt of the mass bombing. The Germans declared that the destruction was particularly heavy in these districts. Factory regions northeast of the Thames Estuary came in for some wicked punishment, according to the High Command, and ships along the river were hit. German pilots reported that they saw tremendous explosion in some parts of the city, and that fire started could be seen for miles. Other details are likely to be released later today. Earlier last night, the Germans are said to have shot down three British Spitfires and air battles off the south coast of England. One of Germany's flying aces is credited with two of them, scoring his 33rd and 34th air victories. No German losses are reported. The fourth British plane of the day is marched up to German anti-aircraft batteries in North Africa. The RAF was over Western Germany last night, but the Germans denied that any damage was done to military objectives or industrial works. At sea, the German submarines are said to have added another 59,500 tons of enemy shipping to the already huge total of British shipping losses. Another 21,000 tons is reported badly damaged. Their reconnaissance bombers claim to have accounted for another 7,000 tons sunk and to have damaged two other ships totaling 10,000 tons. The Berlin political front is in the doldrums. The new Hungarian foreign minister arrives here tomorrow to see German Foreign Minister von Ribbentrop. But Wilhelmstrasse circles regard the visit as purely routine. It's not known whether or not the Hungarian envoy will see Hitler before he returns to his own country. And today it's officially announced that a reply to Hitler's letter to the Turkish government has been received. On the Wilhelmstrasse, it was said that the situation has been clarified. A question as to whether the clarification was in a negative or positive sense went unanswered. The most interesting feature in today's out-of-town press is an open letter in the Hamburger Friendenblatt addressed to Mr. Wendell Wilkie, who, you may recall, was called a traitor to his people, meaning the Germans, by Berlin newspapers earlier this week. The open letter is written by a German, a certain Peter Müller, who claims to have lived for many years in the state of Wisconsin, in Chicago, San Francisco, and New York. He said he liked the United States well enough until he saw a 4th of July celebration in Chicago, when, he says, fireworks were shot off, rubbish burned in the squares, and white and black men behaved like animals. All this had a strange effect on Peter Müller, and for some reason or another, he asked himself the following question, quote, what does a German mean to this country where he has fertilized the soil with his blood and labor for a century, unquote. Mr. Müller, later the United States, hit upon a one-word answer, quote, nothing, unquote. Then, after Mr. Müller has related his sad 4th of July experience and his conclusion, he writes that now Germans are asking themselves what the merits of the Americans are that they should be so well off. Do they care for what the Lord has given them so abundantly, it questions? No, claims Müller. They simply exploit the Lord's gift and throw the leavings away. Then the writer gets to the point with Mr. Wendell Wilkie, and I'll quote from Mr. Müller's letter. Transfer 80 million Germans to the United States, Mr. Wendell Wilkie, and they will make that country a paradise, unquote. Still addressing the late presidential candidate, who incidentally lost me a $10 bet in election time, and who the Germans think ought to feel thoroughly ashamed of themselves by now, Mr. Moore suggests that he read Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf and try to apply some of the book's reasoning to the United States. Muller is of the opinion that Hitler wouldn't even be angry if Mr. Wilkie pretended it was his own idea. An American consular official was scheduled to see Dick Hotlett, young American newspaper man held in jail here on espionage charges today. This is taken to indicate the preliminary investigation of the case by the Gestapo is finished. This is Charles Lanius in Berlin. I now return you to NBC in New York.
And now Earl Godwin gives you his reports of developments at home from our newsroom in Washington.
Good morning, folks. Carry out what Charles Lanius was saying, transferring 80 million Germans to the United States and making a paradise of this country. You'd never find anybody here among the embassies and legations of those governments in exile that will give any okay on that. I'm going to say something a little more about that later if I have time, but Washington wakes up today with the feeling that the lease-lend program is all set. The House having passed that huge measure with a 6-1 vote, as Sam Rayburn, the Speaker, predicted. The Senate committee gets the bill and go to work on it this afternoon, and we begin to hear tales of battleships to be built for our Navy, twice as large as any battleships ever built anywhere on Earth before. That's not a part of the lease-lend bill, but is hidden under a mass of figures in the Naval Affairs Appropriations Bill, the one they're working on now, $3 billion for the conduct of the Navy for the next year and the new ships to be built. There are five of these huge super battleships, according to Representative Maas of Minnesota, who's a member of the Naval Affairs Committee, and they will run, he says, from 60 to 65,000 tons in size when launched and armed. The largest ship we now have is the North Carolina, 35,000 tons, and that's to be commissioned this spring. Another huge project is that St. Lawrence Seaway, which is okayed in an agreement between this country and Canada and is in the headlines and newscasts today and needs congressional approval, by the way. That seaway makes the St. Lawrence River a runway for ocean-going ships from our Great Lakes in the middle of our continent right out into the Atlantic Ocean via the St. Lawrence River. Make Chicago, for instance, a seaport town. And it is described here as a project second only to the Panama Canal. In addition to canalizing the St. Lawrence, there's a plan in the agreement for a huge power dam to generate untold amounts of electric power for use in the Middle West. The president calls this project a defense project. That is looked on here as a tip that he may think the war will last 4 years at least. No project, no dam of this St. Lawrence size could be brought to completion any sooner than that. At least so the Washington Gossip has it this morning. The Army is preparing for a second selective service day, sometime later this year, in the fall, I should say, to take care of the young men reaching 21 since last October. About 1.25 million boys have become men since last registration day. Incidentally, the Army officials say privately they do not contemplate stretching out the National Guard term of a year in camp. They would rather send the outfit home and train some more. And as to those Germans making America a paradise if they got here, the minister of Norway is going out into the Middle West in the spring and carry on a speaking tour between here and St. Paul and Minneapolis, telling the facts of the German invasion. He intends to be in Minneapolis in April. Earl Godwin says goodbye. That's the news from Washington at this time.
From Rome, we learn that hard fighting was said to be taking place in the Caron sector of Eritrea, with the Italians counterattacking despite previous losses and intense enemy air action. The Daily War Bulletin said fascist planes were taking an active part in the Caron battle, bombing British batteries and machine-gunning troops and motor transport. NBC keeps you informed on ever-changing events in this ever-changing world. If you want to be among the first in the know, we invite you to keep your dial tuned to this station. This is the National Broadcasting Company.